Relationships. As humans, we're hardwired for them. What would it be like to have a guide to relationships that are authentic? Tap into the collective wisdom of teachers, authors, and healers who have accumulated experience on this subject. I've learned that there are overlapping soul circles of people in our lives. Family of choice. Welcome to the family.
And welcome to It's All About Relationships. I'm your host, Edie Weinstein. And every week I bring you some pretty amazing people. And the music that ushers us into the show was created by my friend Barry Goldstein. Prayer of the Heart is the name of the song. And you can find all of Barry's beautiful music at barrygoldsteinmusic.com. Tonight, my guest is someone that I've known, we figured out, maybe 30 years. And she was on our show before, but before a major life-changing event took place. Her name is Dr. Yvonne Kay, and she has been my dear friend and mentor for, we think, between 25 and 30 years. The title of tonight's show was based on a line that Yvonne shared with me after this life-changing event. I wasn't prepared to live without him. She's a bereavement specialist and a therapist, an interfaith minister, so she knows grief from a professional perspective. But what happens when someone who's experienced grief from the outside now has to face it from the inside? So welcome to the show, Yvonne.
Well, I'm so delighted to be here with you again. It's always a pleasure to be interviewed by you, who knows me so well.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I didn't even have to write down questions, but I did anyway because I could wing it with you. But tell the audience, since they don't know you as well as I do, a little bit about your background and the professional work that you do.
Well, the backstory is that I'm a thanatologist, a bereavement specialist, and that was since 1974. I'm an addictionist, an interfaith minister, which welcomes all faith or no faith. And the ministry is wonderful because I go from birth to memorial services and everything in between. I'm a crisis worker and have been forever, and it doesn't look as if that's going away anytime soon. But with regard to the bereavement work, that is without doubt my passion because I work mainly with families who've lost children to death, which is the most unacceptable state of nature.
Right. So as a minister, as a dear friend of ours, Hannelore Goodwin, who also has passed, calls it hatching, matching, and dispatching is kind of the work that you do as a minister.
Yeah, she would. She would.
Yes.
And, of course, the huge part of that, which Hannelore had too, was this enormous sense of humor that we all have, laughing with, not laughing at. And that's such an integral part of everything that I do.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and especially loss and grief. So the loss that you experienced, Tom, can you tell us about that?
Well, I think loss is a very interesting word. Most people, when we use the word loss, think immediately of death, but it's so much more than that. And John, one would say my better half, according to some people anyway, he was diagnosed with rectal cancer back in 1998. And unfortunately for us, the surgeon made an enormous error, and he was never the same after that. It burned the nerves in his body, it burned in his feet. He was an athlete. He couldn't walk. So, long story short, from 2005, I was his caregiver, very full-time, or care sharer, as we like to say. Mm-hmm. And in the last year or two, it was really very, very serious. So watching him disintegrate in a way was very, very challenging to me. And I want to say this before I forget it, Edie, because it's so important, not only for people like me, but people like you, is that because we are professional thanatologists, when it's your own, everything goes out the window. It's got nothing to do with it. And I can't tell you how many people have said to me, well, you can deal with this. You're a grief therapist. You'll be fine. Of course, my response is, would you have a surgeon cut off his own arm? Because it's exactly the same thing. And I really want to get that over. And the second point, which is crucial, is that no two people grieve in the same way. Right. Mm-hmm. Two powerful statements. Mm-hmm. So when I said that to you, that I was prepared for his death because he'd been dying, I think, for at least 2 years. But life without him was a whole different story. So that when he died with the glorious Earth Angels of Hospice in our home, that was something that wasn't shocking. In a way, it was a kind of relief that he wasn't going to suffer anymore. But then, all of a sudden, he wasn't here.
Yeah.
The humor, the life we'd had together, the life we were continuing to have, talking about the plans we did have but never came to fruition because of the error in his body. But that whole aspect of the things that I had to learn about me, that was astonishing. I had to learn things like reaching out and talking with people, learning to trust people, learning to remove from my life those people who didn't get it. You have a history of this also, so you know exactly what I mean. But I don't want the people in my life who's going to assume that I am a strong woman.
Mm-hmm.
I've got strengths, a lot of them. But strong to me means I don't need anything. What I do need, I need the love in my life from friends and family and even my patients, who are wonderful. Working with people with PTSD has saved my sanity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a child of war,
mm-hmm.
as you know, so I still have that
mm-hmm.
PTSD. And they are phenomenal with me. So loss is a huge, huge, huge word. I think his loss began the minute that error was made on his body. And people will tell you that, won't they? They'll say, well, the minute I was diagnosed or my loved one was diagnosed, that the grief work began then, not at the death.
Right. The term, it just went right out of my brain. Anticipatory grief.
Yes.
You know, that you were already losing a part of John. And after the break, which we're going to take in a moment, I want to share with the audience my last experience or my experience with John and then the last time I saw him as well. And I totally understand the idea that, that loss begins at the moment things change. Because loss happens all the time. You know, from the moment we're born, we're
exactly
on a trajectory toward the, you know, the end of our lives, but it's how we
right.
live in between. And, you are an example of what it means to be resilient in the face of multiple losses. And it wasn't just John. Just a lot of things, your childhood, as you've explained,
mm-hmm.
Different experiences throughout your life. And, when you've been a therapist as long as you have, you've experienced loss in terms of how your clients do their
yeah.
lives. And,
absolutely.
You know, and in the addictions field, the same thing. And in the, and in the field of your ministry work as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you know loss from the outside. You knew it from the outside in.
I do.
Now you're getting it even bigger from the inside out.
Huge.
So,
and I want to help people give themselves permission to feel everything. So I hope we can talk about that too.
Okay, that sounds great. So folks, after the break, we're going to talk more about it. And if you want to find out more about what Dr. Yvonne Kay is about, go to her website, yvonnekay.com. Catch you on the other side.
What does your vivid life look like? What does it feel like to be living a vivid life every single day? How do you start? What's the first step for you personally to make the shift that you've been seeking? Find out now. Vivid Life. It's a happier, healthier, wealthier state of being. Get there today by following us on Facebook, Twitter, or subscribing to our free inspirations in your inbox at vividlife.me.
It's All About Relationships is a gathering of friends worldwide. I'm your host, Edie Weinstein. Join us each Thursday night from 8 to 8:30 Eastern Standard Time. My guests are dynamic leaders in the field of human interaction, and no topic is off the table, from sexuality to spirituality to self-love. I'm a best-selling author, speaker, therapist, interfaith minister, and optimistic who sees the world through the eyes of possibility. Visit me at opti-mystical.com. Thank you.
You're listening to Vivid Life Radio Talk Radio that connects you to the most current, optimistic, and inspiring conversations on the planet. Get ready to be catapulted into your happiest, healthiest, and wealthiest life ever. Go to vividlife.me. That's vividlife.me for details on our previous and upcoming conversations with the world's brightest minds sharing their wisdom for happier, healthier, and wealthier lives.
Welcome back to the next portion of It's All About Relationships. I'm your host, Edie Weinstein, and my guest is Dr. Yvonne Kay. And we were talking about how you prepare to 27, 28 years, something like that? 27 years. Okay, not long enough, obviously. And he was, as you told me, the love of your life.
Yeah.
You know, the man that with his how would I describe it? Gaelic humor would refer to himself as himself.
Oh, yes.
You know, tis himself.
Of course.
So whenever I would go there, and I only had the opportunity to be with John a few times throughout the years, believe it or not, and not before he was ill. So I only knew him when he was homebound. And every time I was there, he was still full of joie de vivre, I guess is how I describe it, just very lively, energetic, and enthusiastic, despite the obvious pain that he was in. So how did you transition, or how did the two of you manage both the lover and partner role and the care sharer role that you were in?
Well, the reason that I use the word care sharer is that I learned as much from him as he did from me and cared equally. He would constantly be concerned about any aches and pains or anything that I was going through or any controversies that I might have professionally, always that kind of concern. But he would say, I love you about 10 times a day. And my response as I would leave would be, okay. Oh, I believed it. I certainly believed it, but it was just one of those humorous things where he would say it and I would grunt back at him, and he thought that was hilarious. But the preparation for it, actually, we talked about it a long time ago, the fact that neither one of us was ever afraid of dying. It was the how. And that was something that we would discuss. And John was not a big fan of treatment. He had treatment initially, and then after that he decided this isn't going to make any difference, so I want to just go the natural way. We discussed funerals a long time ago. We took out whatever we were going to do, and right at the end he changed his mind. He didn't want a funeral. You know, you were at the celebration of life.
I was there.
Yep.
Yes.
And you know, I mean, that shows his humor that when I said I wanted to start by playing some music that John had selected years ago that people were thinking it would be The Wind Beneath My Wings, but it was Mad Dogs and Englishmen Go Out in the Noonday Sun. And you heard all the humor.
Yeah.
I mean, that was it. The family, it was a very small gathering because I only wanted people there who were really involved with us all the time he was going through this.
Yeah.
And there was one remarkable hospice nurse that was there. I mean, they adored him. They only had him for 25 days. But the basis was humor. The basis was this is the way it is. And it literally was one day at a time, sometimes 1 minute at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And there were times where I treated him as if he wasn't sick. I mean, if I got annoyed with something, I'd say so, and so would he. And that, I think, is so critical for families who are overwhelmed with the situation, so everything has to be sweet and loving, and that is not a safe place to be. You know, one of the things that helped him along this path was the fact that I was just the way I always was. And so was he. That gave him permission to not be concentrating on his condition, but to be the man he was. And with his humor and his denial, he had a lot of things in his life that came under denial. But that's the way that he lived. The love of his life, apart from me, was Ireland. And I think that was his greatest grief, that he never got back to Ireland after 2005. But at the same time, there was a reality. And my, when my children came here and grandchildren came, that last night, of the night that he died, the things that they were whispering in his ear and the things that they were saying to him out loud were just full of love and acceptance and just accepting him the way he is, the way he was. And my older grandson, he's in his 20s, he was crying his eyes out because as a little boy, the only thing he ever wanted for his birthday was a day with John. So there was all kinds of different, and that's why I say no two people grieve in the same way. And another one came in and said, oh, well, what a way to get attention, John. That's it.
Yeah.
That's the way that people are, and we have to allow that. You know, I've studied with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and Dame Cicely Saunders, and I know the books and I know the levels, but it doesn't always happen that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that creates a kind of grief, or I'm not doing it the right way. Be yourself. You know, the best advice you can get is from Dr. Seuss. He said, be who you are, say what you feel, because those who mind don't matter, and those who matter don't mind. And thank God today I'm surrounded with people who matter.
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely,
that's the big thing. Yeah.
Okay.
You're allowed, grieving people are allowed to say to people, no, I don't think your attitude suits the situation. You're allowed to say that. You know, I told you this. 2 weeks after John died, a woman came round and said, I'm so sorry to hear about John. I used to watch him in his garden. He's such a funny man, blah, blah, blah. By the way, I know a very nice man. Are you interested?
Oh, my.
Yes. And I felt perfectly justified to say, good afternoon, don't let the door hit you as you leave. Now, I know not everybody's like me, but the thing is that you have to have that sense of what you want and what you don't want. It's enough of a struggle living the one day at a time when you are without the person who was prominent in your life. Mm-hmm. That's enough of a job to do. So you need to be with people who would just grunt at you. Like, you know, my famous scream list. Have 3 people on that list that you can call anytime. They're not going to give you advice. They're not going to tell you what to do. They're just going to grunt. And you can vent and scream in the air, and all they're going to do is go, because you know you're being listened to. And that's what any grieving person, were they to be honest, would say, that's what I need. I need someone who's going to hear me. Was John perfect? Absolutely not. Well, am I? No way. But we were perfect for one another at that time. And that's a whole different thing. So the losses are there. He was highly intelligent. He was like at the genius level. He taught me so much about world affairs, some I didn't want to know about. And we had these great conversations. I learned a lot, and so did he. And that's the point in grieving. If you feel that you are equal one to the other, that you don't have to do everything the same way that that person does, and that brings the magic to a relationship, the difference. I literally prayed that I would outlive him, because I couldn't imagine what would have happened to him if I hadn't been here.
Yeah.
And I also have beautiful memories. For instance, my youngest son, Daniel, I remember when he came up, when the hospice came in, I remember him picking him up from the chair and putting him on that bed, and I will never forget that as long as I live. It's those things, the people that just showed up just so I could get out, like you did, and hold his hand or whatever you want, and so on. And that's the power of being who you are doesn't have to change when somebody you love is dying.
And yet you do, you know, the loss of someone does change you. I know the last day that I was there, probably about a week before John died, and he was more concerned about you than
yes.
about himself.
Right.
And, you know, and I remember him nodding off, and you know, I kissed him on the forehead, and I left, and I knew that it was going to be happening soon. So if you could fast forward a little bit and talk about that last day, something really beautiful happened that you shared with me after he died that you got to do that you weren't
yes.
able to do before.
That was, it was exquisite. The hospice nurse was there in the morning. And to this day, I don't know how that all happened, that all my family showed up. I still don't know how that happened. But John was always, excuse me, wanting to make things easy for me. And when my oldest daughter, who's a nurse, Roseanne, whispered in his ear, and he was in a coma at this point, "It's time to go, Johnny." And he nodded his head. We were all astonished. We couldn't believe it. So finally, they all left, and the hospice nurse was with me. And we were just sitting by his bed talking, holding his hand. And I said to her, "He stopped breathing." Well, it's the law to hold the stethoscope for a whole minute to make sure. And I had not been able to touch John, really, to hold him for a year because of the pain that he was in. And I said to the nurse, "Can I get in the bed?" So she pulled down the sides of the bed, and I climbed in the bed, and I held him, and I kissed his lovely lips. And I think, because we always signed letters to each other, to infinity and beyond, and I honestly believed in that few minutes, I passed into infinity with him. Didn't stay. But how, and just prior to that, the nurse said earlier in the evening, "I really think we need to get him to a hospice," and he was going to go. My daughter said, "Well, let's try one more night. Let's stay now more," because she knew I wasn't going to let him out that door, no matter how long it took. And so to convenience us, he died that night. Mm. So I didn't have to make that decision. Yep.
I believe that. And interestingly, before the show started, I told you it was okay to cry. You haven't cried. I'm crying now.
Well, thanks for crying for me.
It was a good cry.
Thank you.
My pleasure. I was going to say, you're my teacher of healing from codependence. So I'm crying for you, so you don't have to cry.
Well, thank you.
Oh, my goodness. You're welcome. My pleasure. So now that John has passed, and when did that happen? How long ago was that?
That happened June the 5th.
Okay.
Last year, June the 5th.
Oh, so we're coming up on a year. Oh, my.
Yes.
I didn't realize it was that long ago. Okay.
No, I'm always shocked when the 5th of the month comes. I can't believe it's been that long.
So quickly, before we finish up, what guidance would you give to those family and friends so they can be of support to folks who are grieving, not like what you experienced? What would be the opposite of that if they don't know what to say?
Yeah. The thing is that sometimes you don't really have to say anything. You can just hold. You can say, you know, "Would you like a hug? Do you need to do anything? I can be here for a few minutes. Would you like that? Half an hour? Can I make you some tea?" That was the one thing. Wendy, my daughter-in-law, called me and said, "Can I do anything for you?" And I said, "Come over and make me a cup of tea." The thing is that people in that situation usually just want simple things, practical things. Things that would just help alleviate the situation, a little humor. Oftentimes people will say to me, "I don't know what to say." And I say, "Well, don't say anything. Just be there." The very presence sometimes is enough. Because when you really look at the situation, a friend of mine wrote a book, two of his three sons had died. And he called the book "When There Are No Words."
Mm-hmm.
And it's written specifically for men. But that is so true. I mean, what words could help when these situations, other than, "Is there anything I can do for you? Would you like to go and take a nap?" Simple.
And I'm here for you. So, Yvonne, I want to thank you so much. This half hour just zipped on by.
It did.
And there's so much more that you have to share. I encourage you to write about this and, you know, really get it out there about your experience, because people need to know from the perspective of someone who's, again, been on both sides of the I don't know what to call it, the hospital bed. But
true.
I thank you so, so much. And folks, please go to Yvonne's website, Yvonne K with an E on the end, KAYE.com. So thank you, sweetheart, for doing this. And,
well, thank you for inviting me.
Oh, my pleasure. And folks, next week, my guest is a new friend of mine. His name is Thomas Zeman, and he wrote a book called The Department of Zenitation, A Layman's Guide to Making Spirituality Work in Real Life. So until next week, I thank you, I bless you, I love you, namaste.
Thank you for joining us on It's All About Relationships on Vivid Life Radio. I'm your host, Edie Weinstein, asking you the all-important question, what does your vivid life look like? Hoping that it includes fulfilling and thriving relationships in all areas. Until next time, sending you abundant love from here.
What does your vivid life look like? What does it feel like to be living a vivid life every single day? How do you start? What's the first step for you personally to make the shift that you've been seeking? Find out now. Vivid Life. It's a happier, healthier, wealthier state of being. Get there today by following us on Facebook, Twitter, or subscribing to our free inspirations in your inbox at vividlife.me.